They had a little get-together here at the microphone, James and Easy. I don't know if you noticed them. And they decided that they would skip the announcements, the speaker, and move right into the raffle. So I'm going to turn... No. I was thinking earlier on the way down here how much respect I have for Easy and Clancy and some of these people that are on this panel this weekend. And as I reflected on it, I thought to myself, Juanita, what in the hell were you thinking about when you asked me to come up here and talk? My name is John Shirley, and I am an alcoholic. It is nice to be here. It's a privilege. Privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. Beautiful day we're having. I have to tell you, I'm sort of out of sorts. I woke up this morning, and it always seems that if you thought the introduction here was a little chaotic, it always seems that if I'm scheduled to talk or something, it gets kind of weird. I don't know if it's just my aura or whatever, but it always seems to happen prior to when I'm talking, so I've come to expect it. I would like to thank Ryan and Roger and Eric for doing the deal here impromptu. My sobriety date is January the 11th, 1989. My home group is the In-Depth Big Book Study in Pensacola, and we use 5 books there. We use a first edition, a second edition, a third edition, an original manuscript, and a dictionary. And the dictionary is of a 1935 version so that we get the idea right. It's a wonderful group. My friend Hillary always used to talk, when he would start his talk, he would always say that he was born at a very early age in a good Christian home. And I always liked that, and that was the case with me. And I think it's important to say that because I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. And my father is the kind of guy, he was a Navy pilot, he's the kind of guy who would get home from work and get a big glass and put ice in it, and he would very carefully measure with the cap of the bottle of vodka, 1 ounce of vodka, and then fill that glass up with orange juice, and then he would sit on the couch and he would watch TV and sip on this drink. And when he would go to bed, the ice would have melted, and there'd be about a quarter of a glass of this leftover cocktail. And I don't know about any of y'all, but that has never been my experience. My mother was a school teacher, you know, so I've had wonderful parents. I have wonderful parents. I have a wonderful family. One brother, one sister. I always remember, though, growing up as a kid, feeling a little sensitive and a little out of sorts. And I think it came mostly from not getting my way. I'm the kind of guy who could be on a playground and look across the playground, and I would think, you know, they're over there laughing at me. They're laughing. I know they're laughing at me. Now, there'd be 200 kids on the playground. But I would be certain that those people way over there were most interested in me. And I remember not getting my way. My parents were not overly generous, so I wasn't spoiled. But I remember just when I would want something and not get it, how that would just make me just crazy. Like, if I don't get my way. So I was pretty selfish as a child, and I think that what happened for me was at some point in time, I tell this, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as an and a lot of things, and my experience was I started smoking pot when I was in the sixth grade, and I don't think I would have survived middle school without it. I realize today that I suffer from a lot of related disorders, and that was one of them. But something happens to me when I consume alcohol that doesn't seem to happen for other people. It didn't seem to happen for my father. When I take a drink, it's just... And I don't care what the kids on the other side of the playground are laughing about. And I don't care if I get my way or not. It's okay. The world's okay. Everything's copacetic. We're all fine. I seem to have a hole in my soul that is filled by that, or was once filled by that, and was once filled with other things. And I so tried to fill that hole with assorted things that eventually, when I came to you, I had a gutter running through my soul. And I've never lived on Skid Row, but I've had it running all through me. It's kind of funny how we'll come to Alcoholics Anonymous and we'll apologize for never going to prison or never living on the streets, or, you know, I'm really sorry. I never spent any hard time. Alcohol was a problem for me long before I ever really acknowledged that it was a problem for me. There were always problems, and I could never relate them to drinking. Long into in high school, they were telling me, you have a problem. Even friends would say, you know, you don't drink like we do. You don't, you know, we do this on Friday night or Saturday night, or sometimes we'll do both nights, but you want to do it every night. We don't, you know, our book talks about we are more or less always insanely drunk. And never once do I ever remember calling my friends on the phone and saying, hey, let's go do some incredible, absurd, tragic things. And yet that was where I was headed every time I took a drink of alcohol, is something weird was going to happen. And I had no control over what that was going to be. For a long time, things like, I used to try and doll it up, but when I was in high school, I got sent to this reform school, and I used to say I went to a special school, and it was a special school, and I couldn't see that that had anything to do with any other problem other than my getting caught. And that was sort of the way I looked at things. It's just, I had a funky vision of life. I remember being in that school, though, and the first day I was really afraid. I was afraid that I'd get hurt or something. And the second day I got to school and I was sitting in a classroom, and I remember I looked around and I thought, I am in a school full of people just like me. And everything was okay. I just started fitting. And I was in a school full of little hoodlums just like myself. I talked about that feeling that alcohol produces for me. And that feeling was more important than a lot of things to me in a lot of areas of my life. I think back on my relationship with my father. I'd been thrown out of my mother's house, gone to live with my father so he could deal with me, and ended up with him. And I remember my senior year of high school, calling him from a payphone at school and saying, there's a Greyhound bus that leaves Jacksonville at 4 o'clock and I'm going to be on it. You want to give me a ride? And that was my relationship with my family, and that's the way I cared about them, is I just didn't care. I was in this world to fill a hole, and I was doing everything I could to do it. I was talking to somebody earlier this afternoon, and they said that a judge introduced him to AA, and of course that was my experience. I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and I bumped into something one night while drinking in my car, and I remembered being in a hospital for a while, and I remembered being in the back seat of a car, and I remember asking this police officer where we were headed, and he told me jail. I got a lawyer for that. This guy turned out to be a judge, but he told me he could get me out of this deal with a fine or something, and he did. But after the court session that we had, this lawyer judge sat down and he started telling me about his drinking. And I've never had anybody do that. I've always had people lecture me and tell me what I should and should not do and how I should control and should not control. And this guy, BJ, told me about his drinking. And BJ talked about that he was allergic to alcohol. He said it made him break out in spots. He said, like Chicago and Atlanta and Detroit. And I could kind of understand that. I didn't do quite as geographic, but I woke up in some strange places. And BJ then proceeded to describe himself as an alcoholic. And he had been sober something like 20 years at the time. I remember he had one of those coins, those little brass coins. And he was flipping it around while he was talking to me. And you know, I guess it was supposed to hold some significance to me. It didn't, you know, got a coin. BJ made a suggestion to me, though, and he didn't make a suggestion like go to 90 meetings in 90 days or anything like that. He just said, John, I think you need to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes I think today we all get too carried away with trying to give somebody all of us simultaneously. And at the time, I just was not ready for that. I wasn't ready for any of it, but I was ready for this guy's suggestion because I had respect for him. He was somebody who carried himself in such a way that he demanded respect. I think we've heard people talk about sometimes they'll be the only big book that anybody will ever read. And he was one of those guys. He was a guy that demanded your respect. And BJ told me to go to a meeting, so I went to a meeting. Gulf Breeze Group. And I wandered in and found a corner and tried to just disappear into a wall. And I remember it was in a church hall, and in the middle of the church hall, these tables put together, and there were all these guys around the table. And I figured that those guys were like the disciples, and the guy with the book was the grand poobah. And the meeting went on, and I don't even remember what they were talking about. I remember Cowboy Jack was there, and some of y'all may know Cowboy Jack. I was talking about waking up behind a fence with some Dobermans licking him in the face, and I understood that kind of thing. But the rest of it just sort of escaped me. And after the meeting, all I wanted to do was get out of there. And they opened the door and ended the meeting, and I made a beeline for the door. And there's a guy there named Ernie, and Ernie's a good AA member. He's still around, and he cut me off. He beat me to the door. He was watching. He was had his eye out looking for the new guy and beat me to the door. And I remember he stuck out his hand. He introduced himself. And then he looked me in the eye and made eye contact. He said, you know, if you weren't an alcoholic, you probably wouldn't be here. And then he let me go. And by that time, another guy, Larry, called me. And Larry wanted to talk, and I was just kind of doing the chihuahua in the back of the car thing, nod the head. Larry gave me his business card, and on his business card was a logo for his business. It had a sign painting business. And this logo was on Larry's trucks. I told you, you know, I wasn't ready for a lot of things. But he gave me just this business card, and I didn't keep the business card. I just looked at the business card. The city I live in is kind of small. And every time I would see one of those trucks with that logo on it, I would think about you, about AA. That's a horrible thing to do to somebody. Now later, down the road, not so long ago, about 3 years ago, I was in a meeting and I was telling that story. And Larry happened to be in the room. And Larry said, John, I just want to let you know just exactly how sick you were. He said, I have a truck. I have always had a truck. I have never had any more than a truck. And I swear to you, this guy, it seemed like there's a fleet of these damn things everywhere. I mean, every time I turned around, I'd see a truck. An awful deal. I wasn't ready, and you're not ready till you're ready. And there were more DUIs to follow, and lost jobs and lost relationships and all of those things that go with, you know, you have a choice. You can drive a car or you can drink. See, I didn't think drink like my dad thinks drink. I think, my dad just thinks drink, having a drink. I think, and I'm willing to trade anything for anything. And what happened to me is at some point in time, I can't tell you when, I would take the drink and I would wait on, and it wouldn't happen. And I'd take another couple drinks, another couple drinks, another couple drinks. And I'd still be full of fear and anger and resentment. And I wouldn't be waiting on the magic. And it just wasn't happening. And I believe that if it was still happening like it used to happen, I would definitely not be your speaker tonight. There is no way. Because it was a trade I was willing to make. Sometime in December of 1988, I had been on a roaring bender as always, and I had planned on stopping drinking. I'm going to quit next week, or I'm going to quit my job. I was managing this restaurant with a couple bars. It's a good job for a drunk. I did a lot of drinking at work. My job, the guys were ready to fire me. They were sick of my behavior. They, you know, I would go into a blackout at work and I'd say nasty things to people. And, you know, if you hung around the restaurant too long and I was ready to leave, I'd politely invite you to leave or ask you if you didn't have anything better to do or whatever. I started selling used cars during the day because I knew sometime they were going to fire me from this other job. So I'm working two jobs. Not that, you know, extra money really meant anything, because it didn't matter how much money I made. None of it ever made it. I didn't even have a bank account. I was making 30 grand or so working in this restaurant, and I didn't have a bank account because it didn't matter. There's no way I could ever get money from there to there. It just never happened that way. You always knew how much money you had by checking your pockets the next morning. December of 88, I had been to New Orleans and blacked out. And I just reached that point where I couldn't picture my life anymore. I couldn't picture my life with alcohol or without alcohol. And I just decided, sort of like I'm going to go get the paper out of the front yard, I'm going to blow the back of my head off. And I remember going into my room and getting my shotgun and loading it and squeezing down on the trigger, and this thought popped into my head. And all it was just almost like a photograph of my grandmother looking down at me with her arms crossed and a disgusted look on her face. And my grandmother's still alive today. She's a wonderful lady. And I pushed the gun away from my head, and I said, "God help me." And I think that's the drunkard's prayer, and I think it's how most of us get started. I spent quite a bit of time in prayer and meditation today and recent and over the last several years. But I have never been able to match the sincerity of that prayer. Because there are no conditions when you're in that kind of desperation. I got to tell this little side note. I tried to make amends to this grandmother later on in the program. And in the conversation, she told me that she used to pray every night that every drink I ever took would make me as sick as it could possibly make me. So I also believe in an old woman's prayers. What happened is things just began to happen. I didn't suddenly say, God help me, and bolt of lightning, flash, I'm sober. But things began to happen in my life. And the pressure was on from work. And finally one day my brother came to me and he said, you know, you need to go out to this place here in Gulf Breeze and talk to these people about maybe checking in. You don't have to quit drinking. You just need to go talk to them. Maybe they'll teach you how, or, you know, show you how to do this thing better. And I believed him because he probably believed it. I don't know if he's one of us, but he's a little ducky. I remember going out and I was going to talk to these people. And it was going to be a Wednesday. I had an appointment. It was 9 in the morning. And he was going to drive me out there. I didn't drive. I couldn't drive. They had taken my driver's license. And, you know, I was going to get it back in, like I'd be getting it back this year or something. And so the night before, I decided that what I would do was I would not drink. I would just not drink at all. So that way, when I got out to this treatment center, I could talk to this counselor. I could say, well, I didn't drink yesterday. That'd be impressive to you, wouldn't it? I just didn't drink yesterday. And so with all of my wonderful will and all of the strength that I had, I wasn't going to drink. And about 8 o'clock that night, I found myself in the office, which deviled as a liquor room, sucking out of a bottle of Malibu rum, and I really didn't want to be drinking. And I don't know, I guess some people do, some people don't. If you ever reach a point where you really, really, truly don't want to take a drink of alcohol, and you really, really, truly are doing everything you can not to, and you find yourself doing it, it can be a little devastating. And I went the next morning and talked to this lady, and I was kind of just out of sorts and, you know. But in my alcoholic arrogance, I wasn't ready, you know. I went back to the house that night. I'm smart, too. I spent 3 days on my couch at the house. Detoxing is what I was doing. I couldn't understand why I was so sick. And after 3 days at home, I went back out there and checked in. Go figure. So I'm a living product of a treatment center. I think it took me a long time to unlearn some of the things that I learned there. Like a drug is a drug is a drug. They used to tell me that, but then at some point in time I realized they only had one bus. I'm not going to say anything more about that. They used to haul us to this little meeting that met in a hospital. And it was the Surrender Group in Gulf Breeze, Florida. And we would leave the Surrender Group in the bus and get back in the bus after the meeting and drive back out there to the jitter joint. And I would complain about the meeting. You know, it's loud, it's noisy, there's air conditioners running and coolers running and Marty mumbles in the corner and everybody's old. There's no young people there, and they're boring. All they want to talk about is the book or drinking. You need to find someplace else to take us. Well, when I got out of there, the Surrender Group became my home group. And I would pedal my bicycle over there on Monday, Friday, and Saturday night and make coffee. I knew how to make coffee. It's sort of a strange thing because I went to that treatment center because I didn't want to go to AA. I remembered my AA experience and that was not for me. And I thought I could go to treatment, they would fix me, then I could go do whatever it was I was going to do. And when I went through treatment, I didn't want to go to treatment anymore. I didn't like people poking around in my life. And so AA seemed like a better alternative. So I didn't really want what you had, but I just didn't want any more of what I had. I think another moment of grace for me was just after I got out of the place, I called a friend of mine that had gone to treatment for alcoholism prior to my checking into this place that worked with me in the same restaurant. Went to a different place. I called him up when I got out and I said, let's go to a meeting. He said, that's great. We went to a noon meeting and I was going to go back to this restaurant bar I'd been working in and, you know, find out when I needed to start work again. We went to the meeting, got out of the meeting, came home, and he said, I need to tell you that I haven't been sober. And the whole time I'd been running this thought through, well, if Bobby can stay sober and work in this business, I can stay sober and work in this business. And it was just a moment of grace. I was able to walk into the restaurant and say, I can't do this. I'm sorry. And that's the only thing that I knew how to do. My social life, my personal life, all of my life revolved around bars and restaurants. That's what I did. I had been doing it since I was in high school. And that was the only thing I knew. And I really think that's grace to walk away from. Didn't drive, so I was riding my bicycle. I got a job with some AA guys. We were rebuilding, now y'all like this term, rebuilding this motel. Actually, what we were doing is we were putting paint on the walls of an old run-down beach motel and installing used carpet. It was pretty nasty. And everybody that worked on this job was in AA with the exception of a carpet layer that had come to work. And the first day that he was there, we were all working in this place, working in this motel, and this guy was laying carpet. And the whole day, this guy talked about, man, my wife left me. They repossessed my truck. They're trying to get my house now, all because of my drinking. All because of my drinking. So noon comes around, and what used to happen at this place was the whole crew would go to the noon meeting. You know, we just go. And we said, well, you want to go to an AA meeting with us? And he went, oh, I'm not that bad. That was a good time. I look back on that fondly now. It wasn't so good then. You'd leave a great job, what you perceive as a great job, to go install used carpet in a hotel. And then I took a step up. I got a job on a maintenance crew of a golf course. And I remember standing in this knee-deep mud and going, what in the hell are you doing? What are you doing? You know, you go and you're making $4 an hour or whatever and just kind of getting by and you're living with mama again. And, you know, you're riding a bicycle. You're 25. You know, and everybody in these AA meetings, these old clowns in these AA meetings, all they're talking about, yeah, keep coming back, boy. You know, keep the plug in the jug. Just gets better and better, doesn't it? And I got a guy that's a sponsor. You know, they told me to find somebody who had what I wanted. So I looked around, and I found a guy who was retired, had a house on the golf course, drove a Lincoln Continental, played golf every day. And he is a wonderful guy, I got to tell you. And he was very kind and generous. All of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I owe such a debt that I can never repay, just to the kindness and love that was shown to me by those guys in those meetings in those early days, when in my arrogance I was not even considering doing the stuff that hung on the walls. That was not an option. That was not me. I wasn't about that. I was different. I didn't have to do all that. But these guys still loved me, and they still cared for me, and they hauled me around, and they listened to me bitch and whine the whole time, and fed me, and took me into their homes, and you know, you can never repay the kindness. What happened to me is people would ask me 6 months into sobriety, they'd say, you know, where are you in the steps? I'd say, four step. They'd say, well, how long have you been working on that? I'd say, oh, about 6 months. I'd say, well, don't you think you should be about done with that? I'm working on it. Well, how you feeling?
Fine.
Everything's just great. Remember, I was working on the golf course and I couldn't make this decision. You know, these pretty tough stuff. You know, which way to cut the grass? Whether you cut it this way or that way? And asking one of the greenskeepers, I was just really having a dilemma with this. I said, Robert, I said, you know, should we cut it across this way? Or he said, just use your own judgment. I said, hang on. I said, let me tell you, there are two guys that I owe money to that want to kill me. I said, I'm living at home with my mother. I'm 25. I can't drive. I don't know when I'll ever be able to drive. I'm working on this damn golf course, and you want me to use my own judgment. Judgment. I used to go to this meeting, and there was this old bald-headed guy named Walt. He and Floyd had come whipping up into this meeting, and they sort of dog and pony showed this meeting, and it was at the jitter joint that I'd been to. And I used to hate those guys, because all they ever talked about was the book. I mean, these guys were big book thumpers. Oh, just used to get all over me. I'd leave the meeting, and I'd say, man, those guys, they don't know what they're talking about. Who do they think they are? They'd come up, Walt would come up, and he'd stand right in front of me. And he'd look up, and he was shorter than I was, and he'd look up and, like, glare into my eyes. How you doing? Fine? What step are you on?
Four.
The truth is one morning I woke up, was tying my shoelaces, broke a shoelace, and was wondering if life was worth living. Thinking about the shotgun, is it going to hurt much? And that's sober. That's the way I get sober. If Alcoholics Anonymous was about just not drinking, well, probably none of us would be here. We'd just stop. Go on about our business. There's more to it than that, though, isn't there? Or sure seems to be for me. In desperation, I asked the guy that I hated the most for help, because he seemed to offer the most authentic, or the most believable for him, at least, solution. This guy had conviction about what he was talking about. And I asked Walt, I didn't ask you to be my sponsor, I don't want to get you wrong here, I asked him if he would listen to the inventory that I hadn't yet written. Of course, when he asked me about it, I told him that I had written it. And actually, what I had was I had a file full of Hazleton Guide to the Inventory and, you know, I don't know what guides I had, but I literally had a folder thick with ways to write inventories. Now, I know it's a radical concept, but this guy seemed to believe that there were directions in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. But every time they told me to read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I would pick up, the answer's in the book. And I'd pick up the book, and I'd open it up, and I'd read, and it'd say, war fever ran high in that small New England town of Plattsburgh, to which us knew. I'd say, what in the hell has this got to do with anything? Turn it a little more. Okay, I'm going to read the book tonight. The prosaic steel girder, mass of electrons whirling about it. I needed help. I sat across from this guy with this inventory, this autobiography that I had written, and he lovingly helped me to write an inventory from that. Because the autobiography and the inventory are not the same things for me. And what he did is he helped me develop some lists and look at certain areas of my life. And I thought he was really intelligent because he seemed to be able to just do this. He knew what the book said, and we'd take and we started making this list of resentments and the cause, what these people had done to me. And there were a lot of people who had done a lot of things to me, I gotta tell you. And it definitely affected my self-esteem. I mean, big time. And what he began to do with me was he began to do what our book tells us to do. Is I thought that the inventory was contained on that one little page that talked all about them. And as we were writing that part of the inventory, I thought, this is a pretty good deal. I might even have a chance to get straight with these people. Probably some of them owe me some amends. He flipped over a couple pages, and it started talking about referring to our list again. Putting out of our minds wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened? I didn't see that. And this guy actually wanted me to list. He didn't say, were you? He said, how are you? And he made me write it out in black and white. Might have had something to do with the fact that the book said to do that. I don't know. And so we started doing that. And I didn't know how to do that. I've never done that before. I've never looked at my own conduct. I've never looked at where I was at fault. That's strange new territory for me. I always thought they hurt me. To look at my father, who I resented and hated, and actually look at my own behavior there and the harms that I had done to him. My mother, the horrible things that I've said to her. My behaviors in that area, my family, my work, the employers, they fired me right here without cause. Didn't have anything to do with my drinking. Those things I was able to start to see. We looked at fears. I didn't know I had any fears, except maybe spiders and snakes. We began to see the fear of what you thought about me. The fear of being found out. I lived my whole life as a fraud. By God, it's hard to live like that and not be fearful. Trying to keep all of your dishonesty neat and tidy. And we looked at my sex conduct or my selfish and inconsiderate behavior toward others. Because that's what that ended up being all about. And we tried to establish a new relationship that would be along the lines that I had just discovered. And I remember when he flipped the book over and wrote six in my book. I hadn't invited him to do that either. And seven, and told me to follow the directions that night. And I remember that night, we'd gone to a meeting, and I came home, and I did what I was supposed to do, and I sat for an hour, said, review carefully. And as I reviewed carefully, I remembered like two things that I thought may have been significant, and went and called him on the phone to tell him, I think I forgot. And he sort of laughed at me because he realized, nah, we'll catch up on some of this. But I wanted to make damn sure that I was thorough, because by this point in time, I was desperate. And I said the seven-step prayer out of our book. My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Pray that you remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. There's a lot of discussion about that in meetings and long, lengthy. I had just looked for for the very first time in my life at how I had been selfish and dishonest and self-seeking and frightened in every single area of my life from the time I was a little child until that day. And it was real clear to me what my defects of character that I desperately needed to have removed were. And I had just talked about them. We sat down and we went over this list of amends that I always thought I was going to get to make up. And he said, you have it, and you have what you're going to make amends for. You're going to make amends to these people whom you've harmed for being selfish and dishonest and self-seeking and frightened in your relationships. For not being a friend or a son. And you're going to ask these people, in each case, what you can do to further these amends to them. And that was radical for me. And I remember driving over to Jacksonville to see my dad and try and do that. And I hated this man prior to this, like he had somehow or another done something to me. And I remember sitting with him and saying those words. And I thought, there's no way that I can ever adequately express to him the truth behind the harm that I've caused. But in a few simple words that were given to me from the book, just that simple, Dad, I've been selfish and dishonest and self-seeking, frightened in our relationship. I haven't been a son and a friend to you. God willing, I can do that today. How can I further this amends to you? Those simple little words. And he understood so clearly what I was trying to do. And he understood that it was just a beginning. Today I have a relationship with my father. He moved back into the area so that he could be closer to his kids and be around us. That's an amazing thing for me, to be able to spend a day on the golf course with him and never have a harsh word, to actually be able to get along and treat him like a friend. You know, it's important for me to know, have a very clear-cut way to determine whether I was actually following through with my amends. And one of the ways that I could do that was I could look at my checkbook. Because part of the deal was, is I owed people money. Either because I had borrowed money and not repaid it, or because I had stolen money. And I had to go to those people and make terms. Because you remember, I'm now making $4 an hour and cutting grass on a golf course, so I'm not self-supporting through my own contributions. But I did go to these people and I'd say, can I pay you $5 a week? Can I pay you $50 a month? Can I pay you? And that was how I had to do it. And I couldn't have done that myself. I think that's a God deal, and my sponsor had hammered on me about making the best terms possible. And he said, son, you have a lifetime, and you need to take care of this, and it has to start somewhere. To the best of my knowledge, I paid those debts. And I've written those checks on a weekly basis or on a monthly basis. And today they're gone. And I couldn't have imagined that. I couldn't have imagined that those debts would have disappeared like that. But just a day at a time and doing what I've committed to do has done that. That's important for me. We were talking last night at a meeting I was in about the 10th step, and the 10th step in our book. It's important, it was pointed out to me, that I needed to practice a 10th step throughout the day. That the 10th step wasn't something that I could postpone until the evening when I went to bed. That I needed to continue to watch for selfish, dishonest, resentful behavior throughout the day. And that I had to really stay on top of that. I'm a guy who suffers from anger. I get angry really quick. And I was told that that was the dubious luxury of normal men, and that that was something I could not afford. if you knew about my day-to-day, it's been a while, and this is an ongoing deal. I had a call from the boss chewing me out about something I didn't have anything to do with. I've been at work today. I think I lost a big account today. On the way over here, I spilled a 32-ounce Coke on the floorboard of my car. Those are always nice. Tried to make a phone call from the payphone out here, and it ate my 35 cent. And I said, I'm going to go sit in the meeting and pray a little bit. God's given me a gift today, and it's just to be able to just say, okay, what's next? And it's okay, no matter what it is. But the 10th step in our book makes us a promise, and it said that I would be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. That I wouldn't even have sworn off. And I thought, coming to AA, that one day at a time, you people had to live 10 years or 5 years, just kind of like going, one day at a time, I'm not drinking today. Things are wonderful. And I know today that that's not what it is. I know today that that's a gift that's given to us. And I had to learn that. The promises in my book, my original big book, were torn out by my cat. I have a frisky cat that I still have today, and it just ripped that page out. So that was a page in my big book that I couldn't read. And started talking about the 10th step on the next page. So those were the things that I read. I was in a meeting one night, and it was at a meeting, I don't know, 2 years, something like that. And they read those promises out of the book. And it was the first time that I'd heard them read like that. Now, I know a lot of y'all have it's common, but in Pensacola, it's just not common. And as they read that, I remember I was sitting there, and it was a friend of mine, Barney, reading it. And I was reading it, and I said, yeah. All of that has happened in my life. All of that has happened in my life. What a check to see. Where are you? I couldn't believe it. Then the 10th step. I was driving along one day, came back from Alabama, was driving home, and I had this thought, I'm going to pass right by this little neighborhood bar that I used to hang out in. And I could swing in there and just say hello to some old friends. Nothing wrong with that. I'd just swing by and say hello. And in my mind, I could picture the place. It had this beautiful copper bar. Just gorgeous. And they had these big fancy taps on the bar for beer. And I could picture that in my mind as I drove along. And I could picture my friend Brett back there quaffing off one of those big beers in one of those big frosty mugs and just drifted down the side and the ice floating up from the bottom of the mug to the top. And then my mind went right through that into a big tall glass of vodka. And I started to get the gag reflex. And I really believed that I was going to have to pull off the road to throw up. And see, our book says that we will recoil from alcohol as from a hot flame. For me today, that was, you know, a year and a half, 2 years into sobriety. And God had given me a gift. He had let me know that I can go anywhere any man can go, and he'll watch for me. But I got to make sure that I'm doing my part of this deal. Our book says we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I remember calling my sponsor, and I was out of sorts, and I couldn't figure out what the problem was. I said, I don't know, maybe it's my prayer life, or maybe, I don't know, I just don't quite get it. And I was... By this time, I had gotten a driver's license. It's amazing. I was doing sales. I was an outside salesperson. I'm successful now all of a sudden. You know, I got it. Everything's okay. And I was doing meetings, and I was sponsoring people. I was rabid in the beginning. But I couldn't figure out. There was just something out of sorts in my life. And he pointed me to that paragraph in the 10th step. And I said, I know what it says. This is what we have as a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. That was where it ended to me. Didn't say anything else. He said, read it. Contingent on the spiritual condition. Then it says, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. What I was doing is I was running around, and I had sort of an AA spiritual life, and I had a personal spiritual life, and I had a work spiritual life. And they were all different. And God was allowed into each one of those as I would allow, but not in the totality. And I believe that's what that's telling me, is that God's got to be a big part, a major part, the entire part of all areas of my life, without exception. I can't put God in a box and I can't separate Him and decide what is and what is not appropriate. It was a big lesson for me. I'm going to talk just a teeny bit about 11th step. I know I'm running short on time. I have some wonderful spiritual advisors. A good friend of mine was a priest, and I've read a lot of spiritual books and whatnot. And I could not quite get this prayer and meditation. I thought that it was going to have to really be some secret. You know, you read a whole bunch of books, and you know, maybe just one day it'll just sort of come to you. And my sponsor kept pointing me to the 11th step in our book. And I couldn't really understand. You know, it's just a page. There's just not enough information there for me. It's kind of like the 6th and 7th step. There's just two paragraphs. There's not enough information for me. He said, do you do it? I said, yeah, I've been doing it. He said, well, spend some time thinking about it. And what I began to realize is that at the end of the day, when I carefully reviewed my day and got quiet and asked myself slowly, just the way I did the inventory, where have you been selfish today? Where have you been dishonest today? Have you been self-seeking? What were you afraid of? I've never made 100 in that test in my life. So what was happening there without my realizing it is that prayer and meditation and self-evaluation had gone quite nicely together. And the meditation was I could see clearly where I was wrong and what I needed to do in order to fit myself back to be of maximum service to God and people about me. It's very clear. It told me what to do to ask for forgiveness, show me what actions I should take. If I need to, talk to somebody about it. It gave me specific directions about waking up. And if I can wake up and say, God, please allow me to be divorced of self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives, I'm doing great. If I can wake up with that thought, I am doing great. I am way ahead of the game. And I don't think it's any accident that that book says self-pity to start with. Because all of a sudden, if I can't be mad at you all the time, then I go the other extreme, and I'm sorry for myself. It's not going my way. I'm just a poor little alcoholic. Our 12th step has, having had a spiritual awakening, is a result of these steps. Something has happened in my life that I can't quite explain. And I can't carry that across. I can't tell you about that. I can't give that to you. I can share with you sort of what's happened in my life. But the way you have to find out what's really happened in my life is you have to come home with me. You have to go to work with me. You have to ask my family. what's happened to me. Because my family is a believer in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because they have experienced Alcoholics Anonymous firsthand through me. Clearly. And if you ask them if Alcoholics Anonymous works, you betcha they'll tell you it does. They'll tell you it does in a big way. And they'll tell you it's blessed their lives. And it certainly blessed my life. Everything I have today owed to Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. And my life has gotten progressively better in this program. It hasn't taken light leaps simultaneously. I didn't walk in and things were just brilliant. But progressively, slowly, God has led me, guided me, and taken me through these little, small steps. Never gave me more than I could handle, especially of success, because that's something I don't do well with. He's slowly given me just little bits at a time. I've been blessed in Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of other ways. I've been given the opportunity to serve in all sorts of ways. I talked about making coffee. I've been given the opportunity, the surrender group, crazy. Here I am, I'm 8 months sober or so, and they give me the checkbook and tell me, you're the treasurer. And I'm saying, I'm a thief, and you're giving me the checkbook. But that's the way Alcoholics Anonymous does, is we don't get jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous when we're ready for them. We get jobs long before we're ready for them, and we learn how to do them. I got the chance to serve as a GSR and a DCM. I've served as an area, just in finishing a term as an area chairperson, and I'm going to be rotating as the alternate delegate for Alabama, Northwest Florida. It still absolutely amazes me that you would give me that sort of confidence. I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I came in here, and I couldn't be trusted in your house. And yet you've trusted me to carry your word. What a gift. And it continues to grow. It's funny because I came in and I thought I have some debt to pay to Alcoholics Anonymous. That I'm sober today, and I owe you something. And I thought that there was a fee that could be paid for that debt. But what's happened is every time I have tried to repay that debt, the action of repayment has caused me to become more indebted. And that has increased exponentially to the point today that I can live the rest of my life just on what's happened to me today and never repay the debt. And I'd like to thank you for that. Thank you.